Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk on the Yasa Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches the importance of seclusion for meditation practice. This talk includes Sangha Q&A and discussion and was recorded at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey on November 29, 2016. This talk concludes with meta-intentional meditation. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace.
So tonight's talk is on the Yasa Sutta, the sutta on developing the understanding of the importance of seclusion and from disengaging from the world. If you have any questions that relate to the talk, please holler out. And after I'm done with the talk, we'll go around the room for comments and discussion. This short sutta teaches that developing the wisdom of the Buddha will bring the ability to avoid self-aggrandizing and the distraction that occurs from creating a Dhamma practice that is dependent on external entanglements as its theme. I know I don't use that word often, but the word theme is often used in translations. And really what it means, and it's a somewhat indirect term, a theme is simply viewing the world from a self-referential viewpoint. In other words, we create a theme out of the world as opposed to what's actually occurring. Is that clear? Good. It took me a while to figure out this is from Thanissaro's translations, what he really meant by theme. But I figured it out, and actually I had an email conversation with him about it. Two additional suttas show how two monks developed the understanding of the importance of seclusion in their Dhamma practice. Consistent participation with a well-focused Sangha is very important in developing a useful Dhamma practice, but overindulgence and dependence on a group practice is counterproductive to developing the Dhamma. While the Buddha always emphasized the importance of a well-focused Sangha, he also taught that Dhamma practice depends on and flourishes in seclusion. As in all things with the Buddha's teachings, the middle way is the guiding principle. The Yasa Sutta. The Buddha was teaching in Ikkanagala. The locals all knew of the Buddha as a rightly self-awakened human being who is unexcelled as a teacher, whose teachings are entirely useful and practical. They were a close-knit group who depended on their group for direction and guidance rather than the Buddha's direct teachings. In other words, they kind of came to a group consensus of what their spiritual practice should be rather than following what the Buddha was teaching, which is common. They prepared a feast with many delicacies for the Buddha and his Sangha. They approached the Buddha's dwelling and began making a noisy racket because of their excitement. They're going to meet the Buddha finally and be able to bestow honor on him and his Sangha. The venerable Nagita was attending the Buddha. The Buddha asked Nagita what the racket was about. "Great teacher, those are the locals who have brought many delicacies to honor you and the Sangha." This is a really interesting response that the Buddha gives Nagita. "Nagita, I do not seek honor or recognition. Whoever cannot obtain through their own understanding and with ease, as I do, the pleasure of renunciation, the pleasure of seclusion, the pleasure of peace, the pleasure of self-awakening, let them consent to this common pleasure. This dulling pleasure, this pleasure born of gain and of receiving offerings and of fame." So he's directly relating his understanding of what's occurring. It's not rooted in a sincere desire for developing the Dhamma, but rather their own group craving to attach themselves to a certain teaching. And the Buddha was very, very clear throughout his teaching that he wasn't doing this for honor or praise or develop any type of following. He was doing it for one simple reason, to develop an understanding of suffering and to bring that cessation of suffering to conclusion. And he also understood that suffering was rooted in ignorant views, including the ignorant view that we should elevate another human being to a place of worship rather than simple respect for what he was doing. And that's what he's getting at here. The Buddha has recognized that the locals have created a group identity through their association that overemphasized their association and created a type of worship of the Buddha that dismissed important aspects of the Eightfold Path and allowed them to avoid seclusion. I've been on a back-and-forth email exchange and some commentary on the Tricycle website about the all-too-common occurrence of Buddhist teachers that had no control of their own their own actions and ended up abusing their students in different ways and presenting the Dhamma in a very hurtful way. And this ties in because these teachers were so well revered, discounting the Buddhist teaching, that they overlooked the incredibly hurtful abuse that their teachers that they continued to prop up continued for many years. And there's one story, in fact, it impacted one of our occasional Sangha members. And I guess I should, I'm not mentioning his name to put him down, but to put it in reference, it's Ido Shimada. And he was the head of, and going back many, many years, of the New York Zen Center. And then there's the problem of Meizumi Roshi, who they knew about his abusive behavior going back as far as the late 50s, and yet he wasn't even asked to resign, and it didn't take place until 2012. And that's really unfortunate. But the point I'm making, again, not to rehash something that's been out there for many years, but to point out the importance that to see our teachers in reality, that they are human beings, and if they cannot exemplify, at least in a very realistic way, what they're trying to teach, we should do what the Buddha says and not honor them and see things in reality. But when we have that need to develop worship of anything, especially a teacher, it'll often cloud what is right in front of us. And again, that's happened many, many times. So excuse me for that that little tangent. But so the group asks, great teacher, please, Nagita asks the Buddha, great teacher, please relent now. The locals will follow you because of your virtue and understanding. Again, Nagita, I do not seek honor or recognition. Whoever cannot obtain through their own understanding and with ease, as I do, the pleasure of renunciation, the pleasure of seclusion, the pleasure of peace, the pleasure of self-awakening, let them consent to this common pleasure, this dulling pleasure, this pleasure born of gain and of receiving offerings and fame. There are many who are unable to develop the understanding with ease that leads to the pleasure of renunciation, the pleasure of seclusion, the pleasure of peace, the pleasure of self-awakening. When people all live together, assemble together, and live committed to dwelling with a group, they are unable to develop understanding with ease, which is why they live together, assemble together, and live committed to dwelling with a group. That's an interesting line there. That it is the constant distraction of an ongoing group involvement that does not allow for the development of that can occur in seclusion of developing understanding of self-referential views. It's just lost in that constant distraction of the group and where the group wants to go with their understanding rather than developing the Dhamma. Again, so important to separate. This teaches about seclusion and entangled, to separate ourselves in our meditation and Dhamma practice as a matter of consistent practice. In other words, that we meditate in seclusion rather than only as part of a group, or we seek to develop meditation practices that are mostly a group experience. We cannot develop a clear understanding of our self-referential views if we're constantly engaged in a group, even group meditation. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. this is a great paragraph. Nagita, when I see a community delighting in their interactions, laughing loudly, grabbing at one another, I know that they will not be able to develop the pleasure of renunciation, the pleasure of seclusion, the pleasure of peace, the pleasure of self-awakening, which is why they are delighting in their interactions, laughing loudly, and grabbing at one another. So he's making an example of their outward expression as simply arising from distraction. That's why they're doing it, because it continues their distraction. And again, he's not saying that we should never laugh loudly or we should never grab each other, but as a part of developing a Dhamma practice, we should recognize that that's not conducive for developing the Dhamma. We need to develop seclusion in our practice at times. Then there are those communities who revel in food, eating as much as they want, who take pleasure in sensory contact, pleasure in lying down. Those pictures of the Romans after a great meal. I know that they will not be able to develop the pleasure of renunciation, the pleasure of seclusion, the pleasure of peace, the pleasure of self-awakening, haven't eaten as much as they want, taking pleasure from sensory contact, from lying down in dullness. Then there are those who attempt to develop concentration in a community where disturbance is likely, meaning we put ourselves in a place where there's not likely to be a period of quiet and peace and seclusion. There's too many distractions going on around us. This, I know, is not conducive to developing the Dhamma. But those that have found the root of a tree or an empty hut, well secluded, which simply, root of a tree, an empty hut, simply means a place of seclusion, well secluded, even though they may be drowsy, they will dispel their drowsiness and be mindful of their seclusion. Then there are those who have established seclusion and are not well concentrated. Meditating in seclusion, they will quickly develop concentration and will protect their concentration. They will end their distracted mind and be mindful of their seclusion. Then there are those that have established seclusion and are well concentrated. They will develop clinging release, meaning they will develop awakening, full human maturity. They have found the benefit from seclusion. Then there are those that cling to a group and takes food, clothes, shelter, and recognition from the group and becomes enamored with the group. They do not establish seclusion and will not end distraction. Quite a warning. Excuse me. Nagita, then there are those well established in seclusion who receives food, clothes, shelter, and recognition from a group. Knowing the benefit of seclusion and restraint, no disturbance will arise in them. That's the end of the sutta. The Yasa Sutta shows the importance of dismissing praise, even in very subtle ways, for developing the Dhamma. It also shows how seeking external validation for Dhamma practice will lead to further distraction and confusion through group conformation and confirmation. That was conformation and confirmation, conforming to the group. The Buddha presents very simple and direct meditation instruction and consistently teaches to find the root of a tree or an empty hut for meditation and seclusion. Throughout the Pali Canon, the Buddha teaches the importance of seclusion as a singularly necessary component of meditation practice. While the Buddhist Sangha would occasionally meditate as a group, they would congregate as a community primarily to hear a teaching by the Buddha or from one of the senior nuns or monks. In the Bala Sutta, the Buddha asked Sariputta, who was one of the senior monks, of the importance of seclusion and the Eightfold Path to end the defilements of craving, aversion, and deluded thinking. Sariputta replies, "The mind of a monk, excuse me, the mind of a monk whose defilements are ended inclines towards seclusion, leans towards seclusion, tends towards seclusion, and stays in seclusion. They delight in renunciation, entirely rid of the qualities that act as a basis for the defilements. The fact that the mind of a monk whose defilements are ended inclines towards seclusion, leans towards seclusion, tends towards seclusion, stays in seclusion, delights in renunciation, entirely rid of the qualities that act as a basis for the defilements, is also a strength of the monk whose defilements are ended." Seclusion is the strength of that, the disengagement, the consistent disengagement from the world for meditation practice brings the defilements to an end. "The noble Eightfold Path is well developed by a monk whose defilements are ended. The fact that the Noble Eightfold Path is well developed by a monk whose defilements are ended is the strength of a monk whose defilements are ended, with reference to which he affirms the ending of the defilements thusly." The defilements are ended in me. That's the end of that sutta. He knows, we understand, because we've actually had the experience of it ourselves in seclusion. In the Viveka Sutta, a monk sitting in seclusion considers the importance of withdrawing from worldly entanglements, and this is in verse. "Desiring seclusion, I have entered the forest, and yet my mind goes running outside. If I subdue my desire for people," meaning constant group engagement, "if I subdue my desire for people, then I will be happy and free from passion." It's that constant group engagement, that, remember the fire discourse, that lights those fires of passion through sensory contact. And if we're always engaged in the world, aren't our senses wide open to sensory contact? Again, when we can develop seclusion, we develop the ability to start quieting our senses in a very practical way. There's nothing coming in. I've created an environment to allow that constant sensory input to subside. The importance of seclusion was emphasized to those in the Buddhist Sangha who were mostly removed from worldly duties but still clinging to continual social interaction. Establishing a meditation practice rooted in seclusion avoids the further conditioned thinking that a social practice often leads to. For most modern Dhamma practitioners, the mindful consistent withdrawal from the world during meditation is the only opportunity to physically disentangle from the world, but is often overlooked by modern non-dual Dhamma as group consensus views. The middle way of the eighth, what I mean by that, and it's is many, many people who consider themselves Dhamma practitioners usually only meditate when they're involved in a group situation, either at a favorite center or a monastery or even on retreats. And I do hear it often that from students, that especially when they're beginning, that the only time they can really feel comfortable meditating is when they come to a class. And that's fine to begin to establish a meditation practice. But what these suttas are about, and what I'm talking about, is the importance of also developing seclusion in your meditation practice to make that the most consistent aspect of your meditation practice, seclusion, and to actually engage in that. And it can be just for a couple of minutes at a time to begin, but that is such an important part of our Dhamma practice.
Because doing it, I've noticed a difference in myself. Because before I used to meditate here in the group setting, and there's a very different fragrance to meditating by yourself.
Yes.
It cuts away a lot of the eye making that comes with being in group setting. It always sneaks in there. I am now part of this.
Yes.
There's the eye.
Yep. Well, beautifully said. In fact, that's the end of the talk tonight. can I use you as an example a little bit? So for quite a while, you were coming here, mm-hmm. but you had never established a meditation practice. That's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Now.
Every meditation that almost ever done had been in a group setting.
And that was your perspective that developed, that alone has a component of eye-making in it,
mm-hmm.
of conceit.
And a lot of desire.
And you weren't able to recognize that until you established a meditation practice in seclusion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even with Mara the Goose.
Even with Mara the Goose. She's now starting to establish her own meditation practice.
Yeah. it takes a while, but they get it. It took me a while to get Bodhi to go along with it, but he did. Thank you for saying that. Almost done. Liberation from worldly entanglements is founded in seclusion, and it is expressed through the mundane involvement that is inherent in living a well-concentrated life with a refined mindfulness of life as life occurs. So I put a personal note in here. On a personal note, it took many years of secluded meditation practice to simply recognize my inclination towards a social Dhamma practice that overemphasized and substituted group practice for what is primarily a Dhamma practice that is characterized by withdrawal, even if only occasionally, from worldly entanglements. In the past, I often drove hours to join other meditators, even though the practice itself was quite different, meaning I didn't really believe what they were teaching. It was quite different from what the Buddha taught. I found it easier to meditate with a group rather than engage in a solitary practice that would have allowed me to recognize the need for external engagements. This only led to more confusion due to my association and self-identification. Ram said this better than I'm saying it. With these various adapted and accommodated practices. It was not until I followed the direct teachings of the Buddha that I was able to understand the importance of disentanglement from worldly occurrences and to now deeply appreciate the opportunity that Dhamma practice provides for useful and effective and peaceful seclusion. I think one day I'm going to be recognized for writing the longest sentences. Which would be okay. I mean, it would be the truth. He's got nothing on me. The unconditioned joy of taking refuge in meditation and seclusion is a bright facet and direct experience of the jewel of the three refuges. And so even tonight, when I'm in a group meditating, I can't help but recognize how fortunate I am to be part of a group of people that can just sit quietly. But my seclusion practice is really one of the bright spots in my life. I'm so glad that I was able to develop it and that it's there for me consistently. And it really is the jewel of the Dhamma to have been able to develop a practice that allows me to sit in seclusion. And I remember for a long period of my life, the idea of doing nothing for a minute was full of fear. And I mean, I would do anything to avoid it. And now it's something that I cherish so much. So again, just to make sure that I'm clear about what I'm bringing up, the Buddha is not saying that we shouldn't be part of a sangha, but we should use that sangha for what a sangha is meant to be, to support each other in the Dhamma. But the basic Dhamma practice comes down to recognizing and abandoning self-referential views. And like Ram just said, we cannot do that if we're constantly engaged with the outside world. We need to free ourselves, disengage from the world, even if it's just for those few minutes twice a day of our meditation practice. That makes all the difference in a Dhamma practice. And it's so easy to overlook that. It's so easy to think, well, it's just a couple of minutes, and you know, I know Tuesday night I'll be sitting with the group, so let me, you know, I'll just do it then. You're not getting the benefit of the practice. You'll learn how to apply the Dhamma as part of a sangha here, but the application of the Dhamma is mostly a secluded practice on our cushion, and then taking off of that understanding, that separation, that disentangling from the world that we've developed on our cushion, to take that out into the world. So that's the end of the talk tonight. Any questions on that relate directly to the talk? Okay, let's go around the room. Oh, I'm sorry, Lorna. Great question. So seclusion doesn't mean deprivation. The Buddha had, and his Sangha had, they lived in relative comfort. They weren't forcibly trying to live an austere life. The Buddha tried that. It didn't work. That's an extreme view. So they had clothing. They had shelter. They had warmth from fire. You know, and they made themselves reasonably comfortable to support their Dhamma practice. So, to answer your question directly, it's fine that you live in a nice house with heat and light and all that stuff, and appreciate how fortunate you are to have a comfortable place to meditate. But find a quiet place in your own home. Find the root of a tree, or simulate an empty hut, and learn to meditate. That's all that it means. So again, we don't need to create a false picture of austerity in order to practice in seclusion. So thank you for the question.
And what we see as austerity, what we think of as austerity then, was actually a very normal, relatively comfortable way of being.
Yeah.
It's real simple in that kind to be comfortable, you know, 8 months out of the year. It's real easy. And even during the rainy season, you have a little, you know, roof over your head and you're done. It's not hard to be comfortable. But they didn't go any further than that.
Yeah, they didn't. They had no need for elaborate shelters, so they didn't build them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all. You bring up something else, but you almost got me sidetracked. I'm not going to get into the rainy season. Diane had a hand. Diane.
I was just going to comment on a kind of counter side of it. There was a time, I think it was last year, when I took 3 or 4 months off from coming to the Sangha, because I felt like I could do it on my own. And I basically completely secluded myself. I wasn't going to a church or anything, just working and meditating and doing stuff at home. And at first it was great, I mean, there was nobody else bothering me, and, you know, nothing was, like, coming in, and it was okay. And then I realized, there was an energy that I received. I did some experimenting, I guess, for a while. I went to some churches, different denominations, different stuff, and throughout that time, and I even did practice some different sanghas, and what I found was there was, at this sangha, even though I didn't agree with everything all the time,
what?
there was something here, and I struggled with things like there wasn't anybody here my age or that I had, like, stuff in common with on, you know, that I was thinking at the time. And I found all kinds of reasons not to come. And then finally I decided, you know, I don't know what it is, but I like this group, and I like being here, and I like the freedom that I have to maybe not vocally disagree, but just, you know, think my own thoughts, kind of, like. And I appreciate that atmosphere here, that freedom to do that, and so I'm done.
thank you, Diane. Matt, you have a...
I think that there's a important distinction between in renunciation and kind of speaking to what Lorna was talking about, and there's an outer renunciation of renouncing all of your goods and possessions and worldly things and just loinclothing it out on Bull Island.
Yeah. Or no loincloth.
Right. But there's an inner renunciation that is really boils down to just right view.
Yeah. It all does, yeah.
To recognize and abandon clinging and craving is inner renunciation. That's so you don't have to create an uncomfortable external environment in order to recognize and abandon clinging and craving. You can be in your home. You can be warm and you know have your blanket over you if you want. But the inner renunciation, the recognizing and abandoning clinging and craving is right view, is where that starts.
Yeah, you're right. And that right view guides you into seclusion. It's also an act. Remember the talk 3 or 4 weeks ago on the wisdom of restraint. It's an act
exactly.
of restraint.
Exactly.
To restrain yourself from that constant group or external stimulation. Of course, if you look at it in that view, you can see how distracting the constant need for... And if it could be, it doesn't have to be a large group. It could be the constant need to sit with, you know, two or three other people all the time, or to use that as a substitution for your own secluded practice. You know, it's so important. So let's go around. And how's your meditation practice? And you have any other questions, comments, or
meditation practice is going well. Good to see everybody again. I saw a lot of you at the Donna dinner, which was great.
Yeah.
Good to be here.
Glad you're here. Kevin, good to see you again.
Good to see you. Yeah, really appreciate this talk. It makes things very clear for me, you know, as Matt was saying, right view. But I'm, you know, on that, I also think that, you know, right effort's pretty clear here. You know, you set aside the time to meditate, and, you know, that's what you're doing. It sort of brings, like, a lot of things come out of this talk for me. You know, the non-duality piece, everything's discrete. You know, your awakening happens in this setting as well, but, you know, it's really what you're doing outside of this context that really is where that understanding develops. And I was sort of at that point, too. I would come here, and I would meditate, and, you know, wouldn't really get it consistent. But I've found that, you know, the seclusion is very welcoming, and I really, really do cherish, as you said, because if I'm traveling alone somewhere, I mean, that time is still there for me. I take it with me. It's you know, your own little refuge. And you know, the Buddha's often called the Tathagata one who's gone forth, and that's really what this practice is about. You need to go forth, or each person needs to go forth and seek that seclusion. You'll probably find what you're looking for.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you for saying that. That's exactly what the Tathagata means. The one who's gone forth is someone who has left the world behind. He's disengaged, disentangled himself from the world. Wrong.
He's innerly renounced.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Meditation's going good. I really like this sutta, and it just now just started reminding me of a lot of the travel that I've been through as Kevin said, going forth. I mean, I felt like when I was 22, 23, I was going forth. I was just dropping a whole bunch of social stuff behind me, and I went off to find, you know, in those days it was like finding yourself, but to get some practice in this seclusion, which was a scary thing in the beginning. It was really scary.
Yeah.
Spend a lot of time over the decades bouncing back and forth between this desire to be in a group and this the feeling of and also being at home with myself, secluded, and that's just slowly started to drift over to the side now where being by myself is just perfectly fine. But there's lots of little voices in the head that keep you, that want to drive you back to the social setting.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't really be, you know, is this, you know, am I just, you know, am I withdrawing too much and what's going on here? But over time, it's gotten to be much more peaceful to be by myself.
Okay.
And, you know, if something comes in where I need to interact with people, it happens very easily and naturally, and it doesn't feel like a disturbance at that time.
Yeah.
So it's been a long, long road, but being here and finally getting into the teachings has been a wonderful support for that. It's almost like getting permission to be, seclusion is good.
Yeah. It's okay. Yeah. It's not antisocial to take a few minutes.
Yeah.
And that's really the point. So the Buddha's not saying, and I'm not saying we shouldn't have any social interaction at all. We should look at our meditation practice not as an excuse for more social interaction.
Mm-hmm.
Treat it for the pure jewel that it is. It's meant to develop an understanding of what it is like to be in seclusion and
it
to use that.
To quiet that little voice that says, this is antisocial. You should go out and interact more.
Yeah.
No, actually, this is just fine.
Yeah, it's antisocial. Think about that. I mean, people do think that way.
Mm-hmm.
That taking 5 minutes or 20 minutes for myself twice a day is antisocial. Well, so the rest of the time, you're likely going to be engaged in a social way. But our minds can get us to think that way. Yeah. Thank you. Judy, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good to be with everybody. I'm well. This was a really good sutta for me because my practice has been really spotty. So I have to admit. So it's kind of re-energized me, you know, to get back in there and re-establish my secluded practice because... need to do it. So, thank you for tonight.
Thank you for saying that. I gotta say that this is a sutta that I've been waiting to teach for a while, and my concern was just that I wouldn't present it in a clear enough way, and it would sound like I'm saying, leave the world behind right now, run. But just to emphasize the importance of seclusion in our meditation practice, it's so important. Yeah. Well, thank you. Mark, good to see you. How are you?
Good to see you.
This year, it's been a while since you've been here, hasn't it?
It's been a while since I've been to the Tuesday class.
Yeah, Mark's been catching up with me at other places.
Yeah. The sutta, well, my practice is going well, consistent. I have this was an interesting sutta for me because I feel like I've been trying to find a balance between seclusion and then also being with the Sangha. And it's come up for me in different ways throughout my practice. I know in the beginning I found myself at times when I wasn't really making the space and the time to come to the Sangha, I would get wrapped up in the talks online. And I found one time or two times where I got so wrapped up into it that like that became a crutch in a way. So seclusion was valuable to pull back and to say, this is what I'm doing. I need to just sit quiet and not expect that. And then I've kind of gone the other way where I've been a little bit more detached from either the talks online or the Sangha. So the thing that for me was interesting in the talk tonight was it is still all about the middle way. So to your point, it's not throw the world behind and everything and go into complete seclusion. It is that balance, and I've experienced now both sides of that spectrum, and I'm still trying to find kind of that middle way. But yeah, the practice is going well and getting there.
Great. Thank you. Yeah. And so you've developed the Eightfold Path enough to recognize that there is a middle way, and that's our guidance for it. Frank, you got...
You're going to be heading out.
Ah.
Good seeing everybody.
A pleasure to see you. Anything you want to say or add?
No, I just agree with the seclusion. I actually started practicing this form of meditation, I think, like 2 weeks before I came to class here. And I don't really look forward to... I mean, in the beginning, it was just like a minute in the morning, a couple minutes at night, whatever, but it just built, and now I have to set a clock for when I'm done, because I could sit there forever. but it's been great.
Yeah.
I'm very grateful.
Yeah, I'm grateful that you're here. Drew, you have anything you'd like to say tonight before you run out?
I'm at an advantage. I don't like groups of people.
Well, for you, I suggest you meditate with a group then. Get over that. I'm glad you're here tonight, Drew. See you guys soon. Get home safe. Helen, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here. Listening to it tonight, some of it was sort of not quite alarming to me, but at first it was hitting me like, what do you mean it's not good to be in groups? I was born in a tribe.
That's right.
And
I didn't say ever.
I know, and so I immediately started to sort it out and say it's about not depending on the excesses. And then I came to the same conclusion that it's about the middle way and finding your way there. But then I started thinking about, you know, they talked about the sort of Bacchus food, excesses of food and all, and I'm thinking, wasn't the Buddha a little round?
No. Actually,
so
those that goes back to and Matt probably knows more about this. This goes back more to the Chinese and Oriental influence of how to portray someone who's deserving of worship. That just like the Buddha says in those, you want to avoid eating to grow big. Well, the Buddha was, by most accounts, pretty thin.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense.
And he didn't have those long earlobes that he's often portrayed as. No.
Darn.
That comes from the Tibetan. It comes from the Tibetan somewhat shamanic belief that long earlobes proves wisdom. So the longer your earlobes are, the more willing. But they're reasonable concerns.
Okay. So I figured that really wasn't what he was talking about. It just didn't make sense. But I guess I came to the same conclusion. It's really about the middle way. And I have to say that growing up in a tribe, I do love being around other people and the energy that I get and all of that. We are a big laughing tribe.
Yeah.
So we're pretty happy happy when we're together.
You don't grab at each other, do you?
We, not anymore, no. But I can show you the scars. But I'm
way down.
And, you know, some of you know my situation. I wasn't sure how I would be living alone, but I found out I can do it. I made the transition pretty smoothly.
Good for you.
I'm okay with my time alone and my quiet.
Yeah, good, great, good for you. Thanks for emphasizing the middle way, you know. So this is really just about our Dhamma practice. We don't, it doesn't mean, again, we don't have to, we have to run away from the world entirely. Diane, good to see you.
Thank you. It's good to
see you
here. I did something, and I did it several years ago today, and it wasn't as disturbing several years ago as it was today. When I drove to Lambertville, I did metta the whole way and the whole way back. And just, I said I was disciplining myself to do the metta. And I'm telling you, my mind just went all over creation, and I kept having to bring it back. And, you know, it was just really wild. But it, and I did it again on the way back. So that was like an hour's, in an hour, 2 hours worth of meta-ing. And,
huh? You wouldn't call that a middle way.
Well, it's a meta way.
At the time, I don't know what I was thinking. I just was thinking I just wanted to... Well, I had a brief moment, like 5 or 10 minutes the other day this week, you know, between times, between the dawn and dinner and I, where I just felt so good. It was like I was in my own skin and everything was okay and I wasn't in an ego trip or anything, and it was just really different than anything I had ever experienced. And I, you know, I was looking around at myself, this is really cool. what is going on here? And pretty soon it, something, you know, ego must have gotten in the way again or something like that. But it, that was the incentive or what motivated me to do the metta thing. I thought, well, I'm just going to, this loving kindness toward myself is, I don't know about it. Maybe I'm, have, you know, a little more self-hatred than any, than other people, but just to really like who I am consistently is very difficult. I have, I beat myself up a lot. And so that was part of it. I was thinking, you know, I just really want to like myself. And I've come a long way through the meditation practice and through the years with this group. To doing that in years, I mean, it's been a journey for a lifetime anyway. And that moment, you know, where it was this really cool, that was, I was really liking who I was, and it was a really nice place to be. So that was what I was doing. But I'm not over what I'm saying. It's just that I'm really grateful for this practice. If the metta, using the metta the way I did, middle road or not, was a practice or an exercise in training my mind not on the cushion. I don't really know if that makes any sense or not.
You are.
I am?
Yep.
What am I saying?
You found the meta way useful.
Okay, that's good.
Thank you, Diane. Mary, I see you hiding back there.
My practice is going well. You know, more and more integration off the cushion and being able to slow things down in work situations, children situations, husband situations. you know, really feeling comfortable with the middle way. And it's just nice.
Yeah.
It's really nice.
It is nice. Thank you. Andrew, how are you? Good to see you.
Good evening. I think the key takeaway is what Mark initiated here, which is the term middle way. When I had considered that, and it actually didn't seem obvious when you were sort of beginning to speak of this sutta implication of, well, we all need to find that out and go there for long periods of time. But I find that there are benefits to both. If I'm walking in the woods and find a beautiful rock and I can sit down for 10, 15 minutes and meditate, well, that's really the best experience. Because there are no distractions except maybe the rustling of the leaves of the trees. But I also love the Sangha because there is a structure here, which you say, meditate for 15, 20 minutes. Good, I'm not going to stand up and go scratch myself someplace. For 20 minutes. And that I find valuable.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I may.
I'm gonna avoid the speculative visualization. And thank you for pointing it out that it is not that, not the speculative visualization, the importance of a well-rounded, boy, even that could be troublesome. A well-rounded practice that includes Sangha participation and a meditation, an individual meditation practice that is rooted in seclusion. So thank you for saying that. Most of it. All of it. We're here to laugh. Morris, good to see you. How are you?
I'm good. I'm actually, I feel very at ease and for the moment in this conditioned state. This is obviously, and John and I have a relationship for 10 years. Of knowing each other pretty much in the Dhamma, 9 years.
Huh?
And so I could probably spend the next 10 years talking about this subject, but I won't do that. And I thought what Drew said, so I have a couple of them, I'm trying to be focused on what I say. Drew did say something interesting there when he said he's an introvert and he's a little bit more inclined towards quote unquote seclusion. And I also feel that there's so much richness in this sutta. And I think what Matt said is very important, that it is a quality of mind that we are. Seclusion is that it's guarding the sense doors and being aware of where we're going out and finding refuge. My habit energies is highly social, and it is, I can see where my fear of abandonment really feeds that thing, and my desire to control my seclusion feeds that. So I really value my own time when it's on my own terms, and I also have a great experience with the subtle anxiety levels that come in periods of no stimulation, not even sitting, but in purposeful consciousness, no books, no internet, no anything, quiet, lazy days, watching, you have to get through, it's like a marathon runner on a, sprinting, you have to get through that first hump, and then everything kind of ease into a groove, but those initial pushes, are challenging, and then you get the great fruit of developing confidence in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and I have great confidence in the teachings of the Buddha and the awakened mind and the Dhammas, because they teach you have the theory, right? But when you practice, you see it too. So the Dhammas are always teaching. I can very clearly, see when selfing comes up and attachments. The suffering that occurs as a result. And I can be gentle and kind and really bring a sense of friendliness and acceptance to that. And I can't help but think, some people know in this room, and certainly you know, that I moved into a community that is a community of intentional meditators and practitioners. So it feels like, this is speaking directly, like, that you shouldn't be doing that, right? You should not be doing that. And so from my experience, having lived on my own for long periods of time, meditated, up and down, having lived with John, meditating together, up and down, but sitting together in the morning a lot, and often I was getting up earlier. So, but we had a practice where we sat together. We didn't. We sat in sangha. Sometimes I practiced. Sometimes I sat in my cushion planning my day. I've had all different types of experience with richer practice, less practice, more practice, being physically secluded, blah, blah, blah. So now I am in a community, and it's an interesting, we've had this discussion. There is time we all do sit together, three of us, crazy peoples, at 6:15 most mornings, but not every morning. And some mornings I sit at 5:30 and then sit again at 6:15. And sometimes they sit at 6:15 till 7 and then sit again at 7. So we have this structure. And I will say that my experience of having that support, and I can see in this sutta, okay, so what, I couldn't do it myself? Like, what's wrong with me? I should have been able to have that discipline to develop a long, deep practice. Two sits have been very helpful for me to kind of get through some of whatever, kind of drop in a little deeper. So I have that's kind of been my experience, that the commitment of all of us to supporting each other to develop regularity. And I get up on time now. It's always been difficult for me to get up in the morning. So, I have to show up, and now they're not, there's some flexibility in it, so I also just keep the practice, and I've kept the practice on vacations before, too. Closet, a bathroom, wherever you go, you do your best. Sometimes it stinks, sometimes I just don't feel like doing it, but there was one thing in the group of people that I'm living with now. There's also a strong commitment to each person's individual thing. So, it's like a commitment that we don't want to become each other. And even the partners that are there, have separate space so that that doesn't happen over identification and such. Then the last thing I'll say on it is, being around people that have done long periods of solitary retreats, it has made me kind of want to do that more. I'm spending more time. We have those deer hideaways in our forest, but I go and I sit in them, and our meditation space is under the earth a little bit too. The thing is, so it feels like, I always hear that phrase, a root of a tree in a hut, and I know it's only a phrase, but it there's something about being under the earth a little bit. It feels different up in the tree. I don't know. So this brought up a lot. You said to me, you texted me, you might find this interesting today. I do find it interesting. There's a lot of stuff in that, Some of it motivates me more to keep going forth. And that's what we say to each other, we have to really keep
encouraging each other to go forth. We are we not? So I think a community in the middle way, I think it's good.
Oh, good. I'm glad you agree. Thank you, Maura. Joe, it's good to see you, and welcome to our Sangha. How was your meditation?
Maybe this is the third time.
Is it? Yeah.
So, I guess I'm this beginner's mind speaking. I spend a lot of time by myself studying. I'm looking for the middle way. And my frame of reference for that is knowing that I'm not on it. I've been trying recently to think in another language, which required me to learn it first. And it's an Austroasian language, and I have a lot of experience there in that part of the world. And it's interesting, because they're very dependent upon one another, those cultures, to the point where their language, the concepts in the language are kind of rooted around concepts like kasama, like being together, and the questions that they ask each other, like when we ask each other, hi, how are you, are a lot of times relative to the group, the Barkhada group as a whole. So I find it interesting that they spend so much time together, dependent upon one another, and then seek isolation for the sake of meditation. It must be something that I'd like to understand what that concepts are, how they use the language to, you know, what they're thinking when they disassociate from the Barkhada to go and do this. That's just what I got out of it.
Oh, thank you, Joe. The method you've been doing just for a little while now, you're able to maintain that method. You recognize when you're caught up in your thoughts and you come back. That's the basic practice. And as far as integrating the middle way, the Eightfold Path, that's what we do here in the Sangha. I think I mentioned to you, but beginning next, well, here's the announcement too. Beginning next week, Tuesday and Saturday, we're beginning the Truth of Happiness course again, which is developing meditation within that broader framework that it was first taught in, developing the middle way as our Dhamma practice. So I hope you can join us for that.
Thank you.
Yeah, and welcome to our Sangha.
Mm-hmm. Glad to be here.
I'm glad you're here. Lorna, good to see you.
Thank you. Certainly I've noticed when I'm by myself and withdrawn, I take more notice of what I'm thinking, of what my mind is thinking. And I'm becoming more and more aware of my feelings that come out of what my mind is doing. It's not vice versa. It's you think something and then you feel whatever. So I'm more and more aware of how important it is to look after your mind. Mm-hmm. And just a matter of health, and that's becoming. And certainly I dwell on things like, but I've become mindful a bit more when I'm by myself and quiet. I think things like that. Like you said, that when you're with company, you know, you're with company, and that sort of takes over your mind to some degree. All the protocols and all sorts of things you have to follow in company. I do meditate twice a day. I withdraw twice a day and meditate. But I do it out of an act of discipline that I know it's required for the practice, and so I do it. There's a lot of times that I don't enjoy it, that I don't look forward to it, but I do it more from an act of discipline than enjoyment. I'd like to get But some meditations I do enjoy. You know, some meditations are calming, but a lot of them are, okay, you know, I've done it. And I sit in my chair, think about my breath for 20 minutes, then I get up and start life again. You know, and it's just a discipline that I do.
Thank you. Are you enjoying the benefits of your meditation practice?
I do enjoy the benefits of the meditation practice. I don't always enjoy the meditation. And I find I flip, I think, to relieve boredom and just change it up a little bit. I flip from using my iPad and listening to your voice, you know, on the recording. And I do that for a few weeks, and then I do it by myself for a few weeks, and then to recharge some energy into it, I use my iPad again, you know, and it's... That's how it is with me. It's a discipline.
It is. That's where that word disciple comes from.
Yeah.
Practicing the discipline. So.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of it is the discipline, but I like a little bit more enjoyment from the meditation.
Keep meditating.
I enjoy the benefits of meditation and the change of my mind throughout the day, and that's a different thing. That's definitely worth pursuing.
Yeah.
Get the benefits. So probably that's why I still do it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Glad you're here. Liz, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good to see you too. It's good to be here. I've really gotten a lot from what everybody is saying tonight. You know, I think listening to what Lorna was saying, it's like any discipline. It's like studying foreign cultures or foreign languages or, you know, whatever your business practices or whatever, you don't enjoy every day. Like, you may not enjoy the accounting end of your business, but you always enjoy the discipline of the practice, because then your books are orderly or you're more informed or you're, you know. So I think keeping that in mind, you know, it feeds into the practice. And you know, I liked the discussion tonight, the idea of not just totally relying on the Sangha or totally relying on your solitude. I'm, you know, someone who can slip into solitude, you know, pretty easily, and have to do kind of the opposite of sort of getting out more at certain points. So that's where my middle road, I have to sort of push myself to be more social at times. Some would laugh at this, but it's true. it's true. But I'm just really enjoying a more fuller immersion into the practice as I have been able to get a little more disciplined about it. So I'm grateful. It's changed my life.
Yeah, mine too. Thank you. Isn't it interesting, the different inclinations we have? Some of us are inclined towards a constant social engagement, and some of us are inclined towards being withdrawn. And the Eightfold Path provides the middle way between both of those.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that exactly how it's designed to do? So. Bonnie, good to see you. How are you tonight?
I'm tired, but I'm good. You know, I think there's a little piece of things that people talked about, particularly the more I was talking about. I'm being out in the world and wanting to be social. If I had the time off from work, I would like make sure that I was going to fill that day off and see people who I didn't get to see because I've been working. And it just seems more that the practice has allowed me to really to not want to fill that space. And in fact, not doing it, not seeking to fill that space. But then something comes up, something arises. Also, I mean, to do my work, I have to be have a lot of solitude sometimes. But if it's in that non-distracted place, then whatever is inside begins to erupt or come up, and it's sometimes uncomfortable, or it's upset, or it's, the sadness comes up. Whatever is afoot in the environment, and so, but sitting through it and sort of riding it out, and I think also my practice, I haven't been sitting as much outside of here, and I think I feel realizing that maybe because I realized because for a while when I was really actively doing it, I had you know, there was that peacefulness, and I have to sit more. I mean, I always feel like I'm always looking at my navel. I'm always like, you know, the mindfulness and applying it in all places. But I think I have to not be distracted from being quiet, being, you know, sitting more than just here. I have some really deep meditations here, and I think it's like the slipstream that occurs here. And it is more difficult for me to be on my own. But not theoretically, sure, I end up not thinking I'm going to want to call to reach out, and I end up not wanting to. And that's very different for me. And that part feels good. But I think in order for me to manage what comes up in that solitude, that the meditation and the spaciousness between the thoughts will give me more benefit. So, it's sort of like having the medicine in front of you but not taking it, in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, so I just have to be patient and get me to the cushion.
Thank you, Bonnie. In meditation, we become mindful of the sensation of our breathing to interrupt conditioned thinking, create some spaciousness. The physical act of a solitary meditation practice begins that process in a very practical way. We begin that, the physical act of sitting in a solitary practice begins to interrupt our entanglements with the world. And then our minds are able to more readily develop deep concentration because of that. So, what a really remarkable class! And I should get over my misgivings about giving a talk like this, because you're all ready for it. The only other announcement besides the Truth of Happiness course begins next week here is Sunday is our next one day retreat. The refuge retreat. We'll be taking refuge in our in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and our Sangha right here, beginning at 10 a.m. Sunday morning. We should be finished around 3 o'clock. So I hope you can all join us. There's one or two folks that are online students that have told me they're going to try to come down at least occasionally. One of them is up in Paramus, and I can't remember where the other one is. But it'd be interesting if they really can join us and be part of that. I know we all got so much out of going through the course last year over the holidays. So
For the retreat, do you want us to bring food?
Oh, thank you for bringing it up. Yeah, it's the idea is that we bring a little dish to share. We'll have a potluck lunch sometime in the middle of the day, 12:30, 1 o'clock. Matt's going to be here too, and I don't know if Maura is going to join us or not.
No grabbing,
We request a $25 donation, and that really is a donation. So don't ever let, like all the classes here, don't ever let money stop you from coming. If finances are a concern, please come. And, don't worry about it. But I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a wonderful day. And Saturday, I'm hoping to give a talk on emptiness. It's been coming for quite a while. I'm just about finished with this little book that I'm writing because it's such a broad subject in the Buddhist teachings. And if I finish it enough, I'm going to give that talk on Saturday. And the only reason I bring that up is to it's really an important subject that is wildly misapplied in modern Buddhism, but it's a basic understanding of what the Buddha taught, and as the word, the Pali word is sunyata, the meaning of emptiness in our Dhamma practice. So, and if I don't get to it, I'll just postpone the talk until after our course. But I was hoping to actually get it done for tonight so I could give the talk in two parts, because the article is about 6,000 words. It's going to take a few classes to get through it now. Yeah, and remarkably, it's two sentences. But they get right to the point. And you only have to remember two sentences. You got the one. Let's... the article is empty of any real consideration of writing.
Empty of grammar.
Yeah, empty of any grammar or style. But it gets to the point.
Empty of comma.
Let's finish our class tonight with the Buddha's words on metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture again, and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths, and take a moment to become mindful of the sensation of breathing. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And these are the Buddha's words on metta. Metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an expression of an awakened, fully mature human being. The Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.